This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on January 25th, 2018. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission on Thursday, January 25th is in session. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. We have two matters on the agenda today. The first one is proposed interim enforcement policy on volunteer mail exemption. And for that, I believe we have a presentation from...
Please submit a document.
Oh, yes. Do we have a motion, Madam Vice Chair?
We do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 18-03-A.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. So back to volunteer mail exemption. I believe we have a presentation from Mr. Lorenzo Holloway from the Office of General Counsel. Thank you very much. Appreciate all of your help on this issue over the years.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. And I just wanted to speak very briefly about how this issue has played out in the Office of General Counsel and the Audit Division and our workings with the Audit Division. It has had a significant impact because there has really been the policy with respect to this has been unclear. So a lack of clarity with respect to that. But how it actually plays out, it plays out really on two levels. One level is the issue of, well, how much is enough with respect to volunteer activity, both qualitative and quantitative. Another level it plays out is if assuming that volunteers were actually involved or they participated, the other level is, well, how do you prove it? And that's how it actually plays out with respect to audit reports and our interactions with the audit division as they go through the audit process. But more specifically, how it plays out when we get down to actually analyzing audit reports and audit division producing audit reports is that, let's say an audit report comes to the Office of General Counsel and it deals with the issue of volunteer materials exemption, and the auditors are looking at, well, the volunteers participated in mailings, and the committee has photographs, color photographs, in fact, on an iPhone, for example. And we take that, and the auditors may say, well, we think that this does or does not satisfy the volunteer materials exemption. We can say that's interesting, but the problem is that we don't have a clear standard with respect to the volunteer materials exemption. So we don't know whether or not they meet the volunteer materials exemption, and we also don't know whether or not those color photographs should be sufficient in terms of proof of whether or not they actually meet it. And as a result, what we usually tell the audit division to do is to note the lack of clarity in the audit report, but also in the cover memorandum to the commission, in the interim audit report to the commission, or draft final audit report, we ask that you raise this issue for the commission. And that's the way it actually plays out between the audit division and the Office of General Counsel. It has with respect to the current status. And this, I think there have been at least 13 audits where this has happened.
Thank you very much. And just to clarify, you say you note on the cover memo that this is an issue, meaning you want to let the commissioners know that there's a lack of clarity, it's unclear. You know, OGC is understandably having a hard time knowing exactly how to apply this issue because the commissioners haven't given you the guidance that would be helpful to you in doing this issue, in analyzing this issue.
That's correct.
Okay. And that you also generally put the issue as a finding, meaning that the audited committee violated something. Is that correct?
Right. The auditors will leave it as a finding, and then we will ask the auditors to raise it in the cover memorandum to you, to the commission.
Okay.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the reasons that we wanted to talk about this and that I was very hopeful that we could try to get a policy that would garner 4 votes today is because, as you know, and as people who have studied the audits can see, oftentimes at least 3 commissioners will vote to move that finding to what we call other issues, which means that finding doesn't have 4 votes to support it. because, in part, because of the lack of clarity on the policy. And so at the end of the day, there's no finding anyway. And so I was hoping, I'm still hoping, that we might be able to do something to prevent the auditors and your staff and OGC from spending a lot of time and energy looking at this issue and having the audited committee, the public, spend a lot of time with the auditors trying to prove up all of this stuff at the end for it just to turn into nothing. And that's one of the reasons I appreciate your explaining the sort of how this manifests itself in an everyday situation, both for our staff here at the commission and for the public. So thank you for explaining that. You know, obviously, if we had a policy, it would make it a lot easier for everybody to know what to do. I'm glad we scheduled this meeting close to Groundhog Day. We're sort of celebrating early today because this is an issue that's been coming up for literally the entire time that I've been here. And in my mind, the summary of it is we have a number of MERS on the, you know, on the record that if anybody sits down and tries to cobble a rule together, it's really impossible. And we have some public comments to support that. We also have Mr. Holloway, who just said there's lack of clarity, it's unclear. It's one of those areas where even our staff, you know, where there's a lot of unclear areas in this law, but they're able to come up with something that they can apply the law to. In this area, it's so unclear that we're not even really able to do it. So I think it's an anomaly in that sense. And I'm hoping that we could come up with a policy that provides guidance, as I said, both to our staff and to the public, and also to encourage volunteer participation. Even if we're not able to garner 4 votes today for a policy, which I don't believe we'll be able to, I think it's of some value after this many years to let the public know where the commissioners stand on this issue. And the three of us, Commissioner Peterson, Commissioner Goodman, and I, have put out a proposed interim policy. It's essentially the same one that we put out back in 2010. There are some minor edits to it, but it's essentially the same thing. And we also put it out again last summer. Many times we've talked about this. And so I think actually having a vote on it and letting the public know where we stand might be useful at this point. Obviously, generally, I like to calendar things where we can get 4 votes. But letting people know where we are, I think, will be helpful to a lot of people at this point. It just doesn't seem as if we're going to be able to come up with something that provides people the guidance that we were hoping for. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, let me just like to commend you for your effort to try to bring greater clarity to the question of when state and local parties and the mail programs that they sponsor may avail themselves of the material, the volunteer materials exemption that's found in the Federal Election Campaign Act. I just had one quick follow-up question with Mr. Holloway. You mentioned that there are 13 audits.
Yeah, we sent in 13 audits. Some are ongoing, some are closed.
Okay. Right. And what's the time period? How far back?
What sort
of time frame are you referring to that those audits have?
Well, I know it goes back to at least to the 2010 election cycle.
Okay.
It may go back, because I didn't do the actual research myself. I got a report the report just noted they were 13. But I know that it goes back to at least 2010.
Okay. So this is something that's, as the chair pointed out, that we've grappled with for quite some time. We've had several MERS that have dealt with this issue, and whenever we have a MER or a matter under review, which is for those who are, you know, listening over the internet or watching this proceeding, that those are the enforcement matters that the commission considers. And as the commission has dealt with the volunteer materials exemption in the case of volunteer mail programs by state and local parties, it often has come down to how many verbs are being cited by the parties. Was there enough unloading, loading, packaging, unpackaging, bagging, tagging, sorting, stamping, addressing, stuffing, and determining what is a sufficient amount of volunteer activity in order to avail a party of the volunteer materials exemption. And it's been a little bit of an uneven road in terms of figuring out what is sufficient, what isn't. But I think what is important is to recall why this exemption was put into the Federal Election Campaign Act in the first place, and to and over the last couple of days, I've just been revisiting some of the legislative history that surrounded the 1979 amendments, which amended the act to include the volunteer materials exemption. And it was kind of an interesting trip down memory lane. There was a Senate Rules Committee hearing in the summer of 1979. Chairman Robert Tiernan, chairman of the FEC, spoke about this and other issues that the commission was recommending that there be changes on. And with respect to the issue that we're discussing today, this is what he said. He said, unfortunately, the FECA has had, or is perceived to have had, some unforeseen effects on party and grassroots political activity. In particular, such activity is spontaneous. Local volunteer efforts should be encouraged since it is the essence of healthy election campaigning. Changes in the statute are vitally needed to permit state and local party committees adequate flexibility for vigorous campaign activity. The FEC's legislative recommendations suggest a number of improvements in this regard, such as, then he listed, local and subordinate committees of a state party committee should be permitted to distribute materials normally associated with volunteer activities without having such expenses count towards the expenditure limitations of that candidate. There was also a statement by a man named Morley, it was either Winograd or Winograd, who was the president of the Association of State Democratic Chairpersons. And this is what he had to say. He said, most political party committees are not sophisticated organizations, but are loose associations of individuals who willingly give their spare time to engage in our nation's political life. And as every candidate knows, it is from these individuals, primarily volunteers, that our political system draws its vitality. To the extent reporting and record-keeping requirements deter volunteer participation in federal elections, our political system suffers. We would like to recommend the changes that the draft bill proposes to encourage volunteer activity, and to the extent the law encourages volunteer activity, we would consider it a success no matter what else happens. It is the politics of party, the politics of coalition and accommodations, which is our nation's best defense against the divisiveness of special interest politics. These amendments will encourage a better relationship between our political parties and their candidates, and between our parties and their members. As the draft document that we're considering today acknowledges, the technology by which mail is produced and addressed has changed significantly in the nearly four decades since the 1979 amendments. Nevertheless, the purpose that underlined the 1979 amendments remains as relevant as ever. And I would say, especially in this era when outside spending has weakened the relative strength of position of our political parties, and especially our state and local political parties in our electoral system. We need more, not less, grassroots participation at the state and local level, and thus I think maintaining incentives for state and local parties to be able to involve volunteers remains as important as ever, and I think is essential to maintaining the health and vitality of our state and local parties. So I think that this document does a good job at, and it is certainly an effort, and it may not be a successful effort today, but hopefully at least it continues the discussion that we're having here at the commission to provide clarity as to when a party may avail themselves of this important exemption. And mail programs, my colleague, Commissioner Goodman, who's actually represented state and local parties to a great extent in his professional career, but the mail programs are some of the most important programs that a state and local party carries out in our federal electoral system. And so, again, maintaining the incentives to involve volunteers in that effort, I think is essential. And I think providing clear guidance is essential as well, so that parties will know what level of involvement will allow them to avail themselves of that exemption. And as we said earlier, we'll also have the benefit of our own audit division, our own Office of General Counsel, have a clearer understanding about what the proper standard is for applying the volunteer materials exemption in the matters that they have to consider here in the building. So, again, I commend you for the efforts that you've made to bring this to the forefront. I hope that we can find and perhaps find some common ground, because I think this is important not only as an internal operational matter, but it certainly is important for the health and strength of our democratic process in our country.
Thank you, Commissioner Peterson, for that helpful explanation of the history and the purpose of the exemption. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are lovely sentiments, but I want to go back to the statute. I mean, it's fine to look at the legislative history, but then let's look at the words they actually enacted at the same time that they were writing that. What they wrote was, the payment by a state or local committee of a political party of the costs of campaign materials, such as pins, bumper stickers, handbills, brochures, posters, party tabloids, and yard signs, used by such committee in connection with volunteer activities on behalf of nominees of such party, would be exempt. Provided, next paragraph, provided, such payments are not for the cost of campaign materials or activities used in connection with any broadcasting, newspaper, magazine, billboard, direct mail, or similar type of general public communication or political advertising. That's what they said. They said it wasn't supposed to cover direct mail. And we have in front of us a policy that purports to interpret that language by adopting a mail exemption. And whatever we think about how important it is to have volunteers working at the grassroots, I don't see how any of this is consistent with the words of the statute. And I could, you know, get into the weeds, and, you know, if you want to go there, we can, of particular issues that I have with the policy. But the fundamental problem is that I think the whole concept is inconsistent with the words of the statute that were adopted. I mean, the legislative history doesn't preempt the words of the statute. That's what we have to interpret. And there has to be a gray area there. There has to be some ambiguity that we're interpreting. This goes beyond what I would call the Princess Bride test. These words don't mean what you think they mean. The words actually mean the opposite of what the policy says. And we might all agree that, you know, there are wonderful reasons why something like this ought to be adopted, but I still don't see how it is consistent with the words of the statute. And I do think that it is a big problem for commissioners who are empowered and authorized to interpret a statute to read the statute in a way that vitiates the words that are on the page. I don't think that's within our authority, no matter how laudatory anybody's goals are in trying to do that. I mean, Congress could clearly change the words of the statute, but those are the words that are in front of us now. I mean, and the kind of mail that is coming up over and over again is a mass mailing. It is plainly the type of general public communication or political advertising that was exactly what the statute was talking about back then. Now, maybe if you had a mailing party, an old-fashioned mailing party, where you have 20 volunteers sitting around in a room stuffing envelopes and putting the address labels on and then hand-carrying it to the post office so that the entire activity is a volunteer activity, maybe you could make an argument for that. But what's happening is these are commercial operations, because it doesn't make sense to do mail any other way anymore. The entire thing is done by commercial operations, and then they bring in a few volunteers to and try and come up with something for those volunteers to do that really doesn't make any sense at all, because the mail house would be perfectly happy to do all of that as part of what they're doing. And it is not, it can't be in any way considered this as being distributed by the volunteers. It's being distributed by the Postal Service. It's, I think, the kinds of activities that lend themselves to the way the words are written on the page is if you have volunteers going door to door, standing on street corners, manning booths at county fairs. They want to have something to hand out to people, to remind people of who they are and what they were talking about and who the candidates were. That makes perfect sense. But this kind of impersonal mass mailing activity appears to me to be inconsistent with what Congress actually had in mind because of the words they put in the statute. I mean, you can say whatever you want about what they said. I don't think that mass mailings are normally associated with volunteer activities. That was one of the quotes that you read before. But how do you justify it under the statute?
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As my colleague, Commissioner Weintraub, knows, the Commission, basically since the beginning of this statute, has drawn a distinction between direct mail, which is considered basically vendor-produced mail, kind of from start to finish, and mail programs that have a significant volunteer component. That's a distinction that's been drawn since the 80s. I have a statement of reasons here. This was the oldest one that I could find. It was from 2377. This was a matter that arose in the late 80s. The Republican Party of Texas.
I read the same one last night.
Yeah. This was a precedent that was drawn, but this is a precedent that's been followed for 30 years, and you can find MERS even before this, back in the mid 80s. I think I can't remember what the MER number was, but 1984 I think was one that we drew from. This involved the mailing of almost 300,000 pieces of mail, where the commission determined that there was sufficient volunteer activity by, again, a majority of the commission to justify that this mailing could fall within the scope of the volunteer materials exemption. And this is something, and frankly, I think that this was a legitimate exercise of interpreting a statute and drawing a distinction between direct mail, which is vendor-generated, produced, and distributed mail, and mail that has a significant volunteer component in terms of getting it ready and you know, adding, in this case, the elements to prepare it for distribution were in packaging, labeling, sorting by zip code, bundling by carrier route, and delivering to the post office. And like I said, this wasn't an outlier. This is decades long of precedent. And you talked about distribution of materials by volunteers. That's not a term that's actually in the statute. That is a term that the commission added in its regulations in terms of implementing the statute. But it's not a statutory term. And as a long line of Supreme Court precedent holds, that an administrative agency's interpretation of its own rules is entitled to deference, unless it is plainly erroneous. And so that is a regulatory term that we have to interpret. And again, the commission has interpreted that for 3 to 4 decades. And it's only within the last, you know, it was around the time when I came to the commission, there were a number of matters where we, if I recall, we still found, at least on a few instances, that there was sufficient volunteer activity to allow parties to avail themselves, or there were at least some heckler dismissals along the way to dismiss allegations that there wasn't sufficient volunteer activity. So this was something that we've continued to apply in the time that we've been here. And I think that, I agree, we've got to follow the statute, but the statute doesn't define what direct mail means. And this agency had to take that term and draw distinctions, has drawn distinctions, and those distinctions have longstanding force in this agency. And frankly, hundreds of parties, state and local parties around this country, have relied upon those precedents for decades. And for us to now announce that we are going to no longer give force to those precedents, I think that might have some definite legal problems, but at a minimum, I don't think that's the way that I don't think that would be the best way in order for an administrative agency to carry out and enforce and interpret its statutes to take such a kind of a U-turn from where it's from how it's interpreted a law for a long standing period of time. So I think that there's nothing illegitimate about the way that the commission has interpreted this provision over those decades. And I think that if there's a sense that this policy that's being proposed doesn't require enough volunteer activity, and that maybe there should be greater evidence that is provided by parties in order to avail themselves, whether or not there is a greater extent of activities that needs to be undertaken. I think that that's, I would hope that maybe we could move forward on that discussion. To say that mail as a class of communications is off the table, I think flies in the face of how this agency has treated mail for almost four decades.
Well put, Commissioner Peterson. Madam Vice Chair?
I have a feeling whatever I'm going to say, you're not going to say. Well put, Madam Vice Chair.
Maybe.
You might try me.
I think what the argument comes down to, though, is basically the commission has been, commissioners for three or four decades have been ignoring the words of the statute, and so we should continue to ignore the words of the statute. And the way this came up, and listen, I'm willing to own some share of the blame on this. This policy was created before I got here, and there were some cases when I got here that I went along with, and then finally in 2009, there was a case where I certainly thought, and I think I was not the only one, that the volunteer activity that I think was the Utah State Republican Party was doing was so minimal. They had they brought it from the commercial vendor to a place where the volunteers, you know, moved it around a little bit, brought it back to the commercial vendor that then picked it up and did the rest of the project. The amount of volunteer activity in that one was so slender that I certainly didn't feel like it satisfied any standard at all. And at the same time, recognizing that for years and years and years, the commission had been just making this standard weaker and weaker and weaker, I didn't feel like I could ding them for it. I said, well, I'm not going to single out this one as the one we're going to try and penalize and exact some penalty from, but that doesn't mean that what they're doing is okay and consistent with the statute. And that's when we started to try to come up with a policy. And I think there was a, you know, perhaps a real misunderstanding amongst commissioners as to what that policy was going to say. Because the, you know, if you want to get into the weeds of it a little bit, the but-for standard that has been proposed, and I think it's a little bit, I think it's a little bit inaccurate the way the policy suggests that the but-for standard has been employed by the commission in the past. There's a little bit of verbal legerdemain going on and sleight of hand in the way it's worded, where there are MERS cited in the footnote and the claim is made that the commission has applied this but-for standard in the past. But I went back and read a bunch of those old statements too. I mean, literally, I was looking at that, the same one you were reading from, and a bunch of others since then.
They're not as easily searchable as more recent.
I know. Going through the old ones on microfiche is really, I mean, it was a copy of the microfiche. It's a scan of the microfiche on the website, but it's not indexed. So, you know, literally, I was trolling through that.
We both probably went through all 287
yes,
pages
yes,
simultaneously.
Yes, I believe so. And if only I had thought I should just skip to the end first, because the document that you read from, which is the key document, was the last document in the file. But I don't think any of those statements or FNLAs use the term but for. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't see it anywhere. I think this is a new construction that you and former Commissioner McGann came up with in 2010 as your interpretation, but the commission has never adopted a but-for standard. So to the extent that the proposed policy suggests that it has in the past, I think that is inaccurate. And I think that the but-for standard is too easy to manipulate, but for the guy who unlocks the door where the commercial vendor has stored all the mail bags so that the commercial vendor can then take the mail and transfer it to the truck and bring it to the post office, the mail couldn't have gone out. I mean, but for the guy who turned on the lights, they wouldn't know which mail bags to move. But you can envision all sorts of very ministerial but-for circumstances. And there had been an earlier proposal, I think by Commissioner Walther, that had bulked up the description of substantial participation, and you guys took that stuff out, which suggests to me that, in fact, it is intended to be a very, very lax standard that doesn't really require substantial participation. If you do any one of these things, it will satisfy the standard. To the extent that you are suggesting that this policy codifies some standard that the committee has adopted before, I think that's inaccurate. To the extent that you're suggesting that it codifies a standard that would guarantee substantial volunteer participation, I think that it doesn't. And I think that what has happened is that the entire purpose of this, I believe, was supposed to be to provide materials that would be used by the volunteers, and the focus would be on the volunteers being active in party politics and at the grassroots level and in communicating with voters. And instead, the whole thing's been turned on its head so that the materials are produced commercially, the volunteer participation is minimal, and the volunteers are hauled in to do something that is completely unnecessary, only so that the party can claim the benefit of the volunteer exemption, which, this is what's really going on. The parties like it because it enables them to put out a bunch of mail and not have it be subject to the ordinary coordinated spending limit that they would have with their party committees. And, again, Congress could rewrite this. Congress could, there's been a lot of talk in Congress about the coordinated spending limit and whether it should be raised or perhaps obliterated. And Congress could plainly do that. But that's what this is really, that's what the party committees really like about this. It's free mail for them. It's not free. They have to pay for it. But it doesn't count against their what would otherwise be a spending limit. And that is what is driving the use of this provision, not some desire to get more people involved at the grassroots level and to employ them in some meaningful way that's going to get them excited about party politics. I can't think of anything, less likely to do that than saying, here, we want you to sit in a room and bundle mail for us, as opposed to printing up materials that volunteers can use when they are out in the community trying to talk to voters. I mean, that's where you really want to encourage volunteer activity, out there talking to voters, not sitting in a room behind closed doors moving bundles around so that you can get more out of your coordinated spending limit. But, so substantively, I have a lot of problems with the policy that's in front of us, even in terms of what you say you're trying to accomplish, but it's still, going back again, the fact that the commission has, for perhaps decades, been interpreting, coming up with interpretations of the law that are, I think, fundamentally inconsistent of the law, does not preclude us from sitting here and saying, you know what? Commissioners have been getting this wrong for years, maybe for decades, and we do have an obligation to stick to the statute. And I don't see how this does that. And as I said, I think there's a real problem with commissioners and the fact that it's never been challenged. And there's no problem with us changing the policy prospectively. I agree with you. It would be a problem to suddenly switch, switch it up in the course of an enforcement action and say, we've never penalized anybody for this before, but you are going to be the guy that we're going to penalize. That's why I agreed with you guys in that Utah case. But to announce prospectively, you know what? The commission is going to interpret the law the way it's written, and it doesn't seem to allow for commercial mailing operations where you bring in a couple of volunteers and give them a pizza and have them do some ministerial act here. There's absolutely no legal problem with us doing it in that fashion. And once again, I still have not heard any explanation for how this really is consistent with the law. And it's never been challenged in court. Obviously, there have been a number of complaints along the years, but whether a court would ever look at those words and say, oh yeah, that makes sense, I have a hard time seeing it.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the commission has been getting it wrong all along, then they probably were getting it wrong right from the very beginning, because there was, like I said at the outset, direct mail, I guess maybe it means different things to different people. I think that the agency right from the outset, I think the direct before the mail was an important modifier. And even looking at the explanation and justification from 1980, when talking about direct mail, it talks about mailings from lists developed by a state or local committee are permissible. And later on, talking about subsection B16 follows 2 U.S.C. 431.8bxi, and in addition incorporates the definition of direct mail from the House report that was at issue, and it talks about a mailing by a candidate from a list of contributors to his or her campaign, a list of individuals who had volunteered to work for his or her campaign, or other types of lists developed by the candidate would not be considered direct mail. So it seems from the outset that there was some effort and understanding and maybe being closer in time to what the authors of the of this provision had in mind was helpful, but it seems clear from the outset that there was a distinction being drawn between direct mail and other types of mail, and that distinction appears to have been followed for 40 years. Now, maybe they got it wrong at the outset, but I guess it's never been challenged either way. Our commission interpretation. I don't think that there's ever been an A8 suit over a dismissal of a complaint saying that we've gotten direct mail wrong for 40 years. And in fact, I think that probably if there were an A8 suit, I'm speculating here, but I would guess that a consistent practice of drawing that distinction with respect to an undefined term would probably be entitled to a substantial amount of deference. So I guess there's a big picture issue about whether or not we might be able to find some common ground going forward is whether or not we can even agree that direct mail and mail that involves a substantial volunteer component, that's a distinction, that's a legitimate distinction to draw. If we think that that's a legitimate distinction to draw, then we might be able to find some consensus at some point. If we don't, and I'm not going to browbeat anybody into thinking, I mean, everyone is going to have to bring their own thinking to this process, then obviously that's a divide that can't be bridged. If it is a distinction that others think is legitimate, then I'm certainly open to considering what we think is what should be the quantum of involvement that is necessary to avail themselves of this exemption. I would agree that I don't think the but-for language has probably been in past statements of reasons. And I think that the effort was trying to maybe distill what was being said in prior statements of reasons. Maybe it was successful, maybe it was not. But it's an effort. I think that the primary purpose underlying the effort here is to have there be a standard that is readily knowable by state and local parties, that's readily knowable by our own audit division and Office of General Counsel, so that it's not a guessing game. I think there was an effort to try to say if you meet certain certain activities, you know, whether it's it really needs to be controlled by volunteers from the moment that you receive a mail piece from a vendor until it goes to the post office, whether or not, you know, five or six of them are necessary to meet. I think the real purpose is to add clarity so that everybody on all sides, both within the building and those who are undertaking undertaking these mailing programs at the state and local level, know what will be satisfactory to the commission and what's not. I think that what was murky before was how many of these activities were necessary. I think parties were guessing, trying to draw standards from various MERS that had taken place, but there had never been an articulation from the commission as to what was going to be sufficient. And so I think that is the important core of what this is trying to achieve. What quantum, I think, is available for negotiation and discussion. But again, that assumes that the distinction between direct mail and volunteer mail is one that you think is legitimate. And if you do, then I would certainly hope that we can keep this discussion open. If not, then we'll have to agree to disagree, I guess.
Vice Chair?
I just wanted to throw into the mix that there is a regulatory definition of direct mail, and it says in 11 CFR 100.147A, that the exemption does not apply to general public communications or political advertising. And, you know, we could talk about whether these mass mailings could be construed as anything else, because I think we do consider them general public communications in other contexts. The payment may not be for costs incurred in connection with any broadcasting, newspaper, magazine, billboard, direct mail, or similar type of general public communication or political advertising. For the purposes of this paragraph, the term direct mail means any mailing, (S), by a commercial vendor, or any mailing, (S), made from commercial lists. And, you know, in 1979, there were probably still old-fashioned mailing parties that commercial vendors weren't actually involved in. But today, virtually all of the mail is handled by commercial vendors. And as I said, you know, the state parties interrupt the normal practices of the commercial vendors and say, wait, we got to bring some volunteers in here at some point in order to try and take advantage of this exemption. So, I mean, I'm happy to keep talking about it, but I think it is hard to say that the mail that is being produced is not, in this day and age, is not mailing by a commercial vendor.
Yes.
Commissioner Goodman.
If we're discussing, first, let me just say that, you know, I obviously associate myself with the opinions here of Commissioner Peterson. It strikes me that it is a perfect, if we're going to discuss the interpretation of the statute, it is a perfectly reasonable interpretation of this statute to define direct mail as that type of mail that is wholly turned over to a commercial direct mail operation, and they perform all of the services to send that mail out to the public. And that's what makes direct mail in this context similar to the other forms of advertising in this statute. Volunteers are not typically involved in broadcasting. You cut the ad, you turn it over to the TV station, it runs. There is no role for volunteers to disseminate that message through the facilities of a broadcasting station. The same with a newspaper. Once you make the ad and you give it to the newspaper publishes that communication. So that's what groups these types of things, and I think it's reasonable to say that that's the same concept captured by the use of direct mail here and in the regulation. It's not much of a gloss on the regulation where it says mailings by a commercial vendor to mean 100% turned over to the commercial vendor for the commercial vendor from start to finish to design, produce, print, mail, disseminate, and do everything. Once you accept that type of definition for what direct mail means, that gives you some room to interpret, to put other types of mailings into, to read that into the volunteer activities contemplated under subsection 9 of 30B9 of 30101. For example, the examples given, brochures and party tabloids. Certainly, we're not going to put a gloss on brochures or party tabloids that say if party volunteers mail the tabloid to people, that somehow that is not an exempt activity. Or the party's brochure. If volunteers mail the brochure, all of a sudden, you aren't entitled to the exemption that Congress clearly provided. So this is clearly an issue, as counsel noted earlier, about the degree of involvement of the volunteer activity. But it's a perfectly reasonable read, and it's been the read that has animated this commission's treatment of this rule for, as Commissioner Peterson says, nearly 40 years. And I wouldn't graft mailing restrictions on the volunteer brochures and party tabloids that are provided for by Congress, and Congress has known of this commission's treatment of this law for 40 years, and from BCRA, which actually enhanced some aspects of party role, to the Disclose Act, to the Cromnibus 2 years ago, Congress has never looked at second-guessing the commission's treatment of this volunteer activity. Now, I look at the but-for test. The but-for test and the discussion over that precedes my time here. I think the but-for test is too restrictive. Once you have volunteer involvement, because the language, if you accept that you can narrowly define direct mail in the statute and allow for some mail of brochures and party tabloids and other communications to be permitted under Section B9 of 30101, the only limitation then in the statute is that it be in connection with volunteer activities. Not that it be but for or necessary, or that it be in connection with volunteer activities. And I don't think we have to denigrate the good work that the state and local parties have been doing for 40 years, engaging volunteers, and I have seen some of these in my history, and it's not just moving bags around. You actually have people in preparing the envelopes, stuffing envelopes. You have people, in many cases, affixing the labels in some cases. Now, technology is eclipsing that volunteer role. But just because the party can avail itself of new technologies doesn't mean that we remove the volunteer exemption when volunteers are engaged with the technology that helps produce the direct mail that they are going to deliver to the U.S. Postal Service and mail out to people. And finally, I'll just close that is the technical, statutory, and regulatory read that I come to in this. Needless to say, it is somewhat informed by the First Amendment and policy issues at stake here, which is that we want to encourage and strengthen state and local political parties, and this is one area of great utility and a significant role that they have played for 40 years, and it continues to bring utility to state parties, which are good democratic grassroots institutions in our democratic process. And so if under the terms of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, it is our job to interpret this and consider First Amendment principles at stake in how we interpret this, I would certainly consider those realities and the role of state parties and bring that to bear in how I draw these distinctions.
Madam Vice Chair.
I realize we're reaching the point of diminishing utility, but I just want to respond to one small aspect of that, because I appreciate your engaging with me on the statute. I really do. But to say, you know, they said in here that there's an exemption for the payment of the costs of campaign materials like brochures. Clearly, they couldn't have meant that the volunteer can't mail the brochure. Well, the very next sentence says, provided that the payments are not for the cost of direct mail. So I don't think it's clear at all. Now, if the volunteer is sitting there and literally, as you say, stuffing the envelope with the brochure and mailing it, maybe, but that's not the way anybody does it anymore. I mean, nobody's stuffing envelopes anymore, unless it's a really, really, really small campaign. I don't think state party organizations are stuffing envelopes anymore.
Have you ever worked on one of those direct, one of these mailing operations, the volunteer mail?
I have not.
Okay. Because some of us have, and we've talked about this before, and know, as Commissioner Goodman said, that these things really do happen. And I just keep wondering, you know, if you're the counsel to one of these state parties, and the party executive director calls you up and says, hey, we want to do a volunteer mail program, you know, what are the requirements? And the lawyer says, well, let me get right back to you. And then he goes back and reads all this microfiche you guys are talking about, or he tries to read the campaign guide.
Have to do that.
They shouldn't have to do that. Or they go back and try to distill what the answer is. They come back and they say, the heck if I know. I have no idea what you're supposed to do in order to allow the party to do these to do volunteer mail, to take advantage of the provisions that Commissioner Peterson and Commissioner Goodman just talked about. And so I think the one, going back to what you said before, I think what was well put in what you said was that I think it's either the first or second time, it might be the second time, I'm not sure, that I think you articulated that essentially, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but that essentially you kind of want to go back to the statute and take a sort of a fresh look at it. And you're right that that's different than some of the statements that you've signed off on in the past, including the Missouri Democratic State Committee in, I think this is 2007, a statement signed by Bob Lenhart, Dave Mason, Hans von Spakowski, and yourself, where you sign off on the Missouri Democrat Party not doing a whole lot. I can read it, but it's not, you know, I think from your perspective, based on what you've said today, I don't think you would think it was substantial. And so minds change and all that sort of thing. But it seemed like you were saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in the context of the MERS, the enforcement matters, at the end of the day, you don't want to ding someone who didn't really know what the law is. But on the front end, we can't really tell them what to do. So that puts them in an obviously, you know, very precarious position of trying to figure out on the front end how to advise the state parties. And the national parties are in the same, you know, predicament, because they're getting calls all the time from the state parties saying, what do you mean you don't know what we're supposed to do? And I think I've mentioned before, I was on a team from the RNC where we went around to different state parties and tried to teach them campaign finance law and try to explain to them what they were supposed to do. And this was part of the component even back then. I remember laughing, you're kidding me, you're supposed to ride on the mail truck. At the time, the RNC was telling people to ride on the mail truck, which just is crazy to me. I know they don't do that anymore, but this has a sort of a long sorted history, and it seems as if you at least want to go back and back to the beginning and sort of revisit some of the previous interpretations. And that's at least somewhat newsworthy from my perspective. I don't know if you've said it before in an open meeting. Like I said, it might have been the second time, but that it's either the first or second time from my perspective. Going back to what Commissioner Walther, and so I'm not sure, happy to talk in the future, but I'm not sure along the lines of what Commissioner Peterson said, if there's such a vast departure on the interpretation of the statute itself and whether or not it's even possible for direct mail to be something other than, you know, vendor-produced mail, if there's a possibility of having a volunteer component. I don't think we're going to be able to come up with an agreement. Happy to try, always, as I told you a couple of weeks ago, but I think your interpretation as it stands now, it basically reads the volunteer mail exemption out of the statute, which is what I told you a few weeks ago when we had this same conversation in my office a couple weeks ago. You may or may not disagree with that, but I think that's essentially what you're doing. It seems as if, and I certainly don't want to put words in his mouth, but it seems as if Commissioner Walther, based on what he put out in July this past summer, at least is willing to entertain the notion that there may be enough involvement to qualify a male for the volunteer male exemption. And specifically, the reason why we weren't in favor of the policy that he proposed was he goes through this essentially the same four bullets that we have in our policy, but at the end of it, his sentence is, each of these examples of volunteer activity will be considered by the commission in its determination of whether or not there has been substantial volunteer involvement in order to satisfy the distribution by volunteers aspect of the volunteer male exemption. And then he says you can do other stuff too. This list isn't determinative or exhaustive. So the way, and again, don't mean this to be derogatory, but the way that we read this was, you can do some of the stuff we propose to you, but even if you do it, it may not be enough because we may want to, you know, we're not really sure. We'll consider it, basically. And that's the way we read it. Maybe I'm reading it wrong, but we read it as you can do some of these things, but it may not be enough. And we were going for something that was far more definitive. If someone wants to come up with a list of substantial volunteer involvement that if people are able to actually do with some clarity, you know, maybe you have to have more than one bullet or something like that, we're willing to consider that. As I said earlier, I think there is some utility on voting today, but that doesn't mean that we're not willing and able to talk at any moment, including this afternoon. We can calendar it again at the next public meeting, but I think in the interest of sort of putting people on the record, that might be the right approach for today, but I'm not sure that based on what you've said on the statutory provision that it's something that we're going to be able to talk through, work through. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify something because you've said that I'm saying something new for the first time today.
It might be the second time.
Well, going back to 2009 or 10, when we first started, I mean, it was the Utah case in 2009 that really kind of brought this to the fore. And you're right. I had gone along in a couple of other cases before that where I thought consistent with other cases that the commission had handled in the past, but the Utah one really brought me up short because I thought, well, this really is this is very close to what Commissioner Peterson has described as bringing in the volunteers for the blessing of the mail. It seemed like there was so little volunteer involvement that couldn't possibly pass any kind of reasonable standard, and that's what caused me to go back and take a fresh look at the statute and try and harmonize it, and I've been struggling to do so ever since. I think it's really interesting that you just said that I'm reading the volunteer male exemption out of the statute. That's because there is no volunteer male exemption in the statute. The statute talks about volunteer materials. Nowhere in the statute does it say there's an exemption for volunteer mail.
No, excuse me, you're reading the volunteer materials out of the statute.
No, there are plenty of opportunities for volunteer materials, but, you know, not in connection with a commercial mailing operation, I think. So I just wanted to, I just think that's informative that, you know, you've got it so ingrained in your head that's the way you talk about it. You talk about the volunteer mail exemption all the time. That's not what the statute
says. That's how the state parties talk about it. That's how they've been doing it for years. It's been going on since the late 70s, 80s. I mean, that's just how people talk about it. I hate to break it to you. That's how it goes down on the street. I mean,
that's fine, but it's not what the statute says.
Madam Chair. Commissioner Wentrell, I hear two arguments from you today. And one is that, gee, if the volunteers were actually handwriting the envelopes, licking the stamp, pulling out their crayons and magic markers and writing a political message, folding it, putting it in an envelope, and walking it down to the mailbox, I think you would permit that. You would say that might be a volunteer material and not direct mail, but that your real concern is that the technology has become so automated in these that the volunteer involvement is so minimal that it's looking more like direct mail. Am I right that That is part of your argument because we have two arguments going here. One is, as a matter of law, whether any mail can fit as a volunteer material or whether all mail is considered direct mail. And secondly, if that's not the case, if there is room for mailing something under the volunteer materials exemption, it's a matter of degree. How much volunteer activity is necessary? And I guess I want to understand your argument. Is it the former or the latter?
I think you're slightly getting it wrong. The commission has defined direct mail as mail that's sent out by a commercial vendor.
Right.
So, you know, if you've got the volunteers, and I don't think they need to use crayons, they can use computers, but, you know, if
use
you,
computers. If, Let's we're making progress if, now.
Okay, so
use of computers is okay.
I believe that this was, to the extent that they contemplated that mail would be involved at all, it was in the context of an old-fashioned mailing party. You know what I'm talking about, and it never involved crayons, where the volunteers really were doing all the work. They didn't make the envelopes themselves. They bought the envelopes, right? But mm-hmm. the volunteers were helping to create the actual things that were they would then stuff into the
yes.
into the envelope and stamp and put in the mail. And that is very different
yes.
from a commercial mail operation, which is the way everybody does it. And maybe what Congress had in mind in 1979 just doesn't happen anymore. That doesn't mean that we get to say, well, they must have meant for it to apply to something, so we'll have to make it apply to something else that they didn't have in mind.
So I think we understand each other. It's the degree of volunteer activity that concerns you. And you're concerned that with modern technologies and the use of outside vendors to assist in the volunteer activity, more of these are in what you conceive of direct mail under Section 301B9, subpart 1.
What the regulation says is direct mail.
Right. Right. If it's done by the commercial vendor, solely by the commercial vendor. My point is, we are left with this, and you said it earlier, it's not clear at all. We are left with an interpretive problem. How much volunteer activity is sufficient to fall within the volunteer materials exemption, and how much begins to look more like a definition that this commission has given to direct mail in its regulation? And so we are in an interpretive activity right now. We are interpreting the act, but that's a far cry from where we started this discussion, which is to say the statute doesn't allow this. So I feel quite comfortable that so long as it is in connection with volunteer activities, that it is not direct mail under the statute. It is not being turned over and controlled from start to finish by a commercial vendor, just like you would commercial broadcast advertising, newspaper advertising, and billboards, where there is no role for volunteers. Where there is a role for volunteers, that I think we're well within our rights to interpret that as not being direct mail, as we have for 40 years, and now we're merely discussing how much volunteer activity is necessary. And that's a very different debate we're having than that the statute doesn't permit this in the first instance.
Madam Vice Chair, I don't want you putting words in my mouth, because what I said was I'm looking both to the statute and to the regulation, which defines direct mail as mail that is, I forget the verb that's used in the regulation, produced or distributed by, hang on, let me get direct mail means any mailing by, actually there is no verb, any mailings by a commercial vendor or any mailings made from commercial lists. So it's not clear to me that there is any way that volunteers, I mean, let's put it this way. I haven't seen a case, certainly not recently, and I'd have to I don't want to say over make any overbroad statements because I don't have every single case in my head, but the as I think about the cases now, I can't think of any that didn't involve a commercial vendor in a way that the regulations appear to say makes it ineligible for the exemption. So I don't think that we're talking about, and you know, when you start talking about degree and 100%, I mean, I suppose we could get into a debate over whether volunteers could so substantially participate in what is otherwise a commercial operation that it would make it not mailings by a commercial vendor. But it's a little bit hard for me to contemplate that, and I don't think that is certainly not the norm of what we see. You know, if you're saying, well, it's not 100% done by a commercial vendor because 2% of the work was done by volunteers, that for sure is not going to do it for me.
Okay. I think we've made some progress, at least. This is not precluded by the statute. It is interpretive. And now we're discussing degree of volunteer involvement. You just said we would look at percentages, for example.
No, but I think you're looking at percentages.
I thought you just said that 2% wouldn't be enough. And so I infer from that 80% would be enough. But let me ask you.
Don't make that inference.
Let me ask you this. What happens if the state party, rather than hiring an outside vendor, takes in a direct mail operation in-house, and the party owns it, operates, and runs it? Then you bring in volunteers to engage in the same 2% of activity. Does that change your analysis? I take it would under the statute and under the definition of the regulation that there is something magical about employing an outside commercial vendor than doing all the same automated operations in-house. And I ask this because innovations in technology, more and more of the printing, production of direct mail could be taken in-house. Does that change your analysis?
It's an interesting idea. We haven't seen that. I mean, that has not been presented to us. But, you know, it's not magic. It's what's in the regulation. The regulation says commercial vendor. Yes. So if you're saying if you take the commercial vendor out of the equation, does that change it? It might. Yeah. I haven't seen that, but, you know, it might.
Let me speak to a higher authority, which is the First Amendment. Why would we restrict the party more just because they outsource an activity than if they take the activity in-house and pay it themselves? Why is it that they lose their First Amendment right when they hire an outside vendor to do what they might be able to do in-house and call it a disbursement and call it overhead of the party?
Nobody's losing their First Amendment rights.
Oh, yes, there are limits on these contributions.
No one's losing.
If you treat these as contributions, they are limited directly in how much they can speak and associate.
That's what the statute says, and that's what the Supreme Court has upheld. So just, you know.
Somehow if I own the printing press, that would be a different statutory result than if I rent the printing press from a commercial vendor with the same amount of volunteer activity.
Because there are words in the statute, and we have to apply them. We can't make them up and say, you know what, we think they should have written different words, and that would vindicate more First Amendment freedoms. Well, and maybe it would, or maybe it wouldn't, but these are the words that are in the statute and in the regulation, and it talks about commercial vendors, and it talks about direct mail, and that's really the only words we can interpret.
And as I indicated earlier, I walked you through my statutory analysis, and I reached the same result through a statutory analysis and interpreting the regulation, and I do so in a First Amendment sensitive way, which the Court of Appeals has told us is our duty, and I come up with the fact that volunteer activities in connection with mailings is permissible under Section 30101B9.
Only if you ignore B10 or I'm not sure if that's the designation, but the very next provision.
No, I don't ignore it. I interpret direct mail narrowly.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Peterson.
And the only, I mean, we may be getting to the point of diminishing returns. The one thing that that I just want to point out is that I don't think involvement of a commercial vendor is the linchpin in this particular provision. I'm talking about the voluntary materials exemption at large. I'd assume that every item, the ones that are even specifically listed in the permissible section, when we're talking about pins, bumper stickers, handbills, brochures, posters, party tabloids, or newsletters and yard signs, are being produced by the volunteers themselves. I mean, obviously, you're going to hire out somebody to put those together. And so, and frankly, when you go back and look at the House and Senate debates revolving around the 1979 amendments, it's clear that the involvement of paid professionals and commercial vendors at some level in the operations, or at least in the production of the materials. And unless someone has a different point of view and thinks that only yard signs actually made with markers by a commercial vendor. So there's going to be commercial vendors that are going to be producing, for example, the mail. That there would be commercial vendors that are producing pins, bumper stickers, handbills, and so on and so forth. And so the way I've viewed this is when I look at direct mail, I think the modification of direct to mail means something. And I think there's plenty of precedent both in explanation, justifications, the treatment of complaints and audits that have dealt with this issue over 30 to 40 years. But I think that it really, I think the crux of it as I look at it comes down to the distribution issue. And what level of involvement in the distribution is considered sufficient in order for the volunteer materials protections to kick in. So just because a commercial mailhouse produces a piece, I view that similar to commercial vendors that are producing bumper stickers, pins, pamphlets, and so forth. It's when you have a commercial vendor that's also taking care of all of the elements of distribution as well that puts it in the category of direct mail, as opposed to when you have volunteers handling multiple elements of the distribution, you know, up until the point of actually delivering it to the post office. So I just wanted to raise that point as part of the reasoning behind the reason why I could support moving forward on a policy similar to the one that we have in front of us now. And like I said, if there is some interest and ability for us to maybe think about weighing the different levels of involvement that we think should be required in order for this exemption to kick in, I'd hope we'd be able to do so, and certainly my door is always open to talk further on that matter. So, thanks.
Thank you. Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I associate myself to a large degree, but not entirely, with Commissioner Weintraub, but I proposed something back last July, and I still adhere to that. But the draft that you presented today has some issues for me that still don't get there, and I can point out a couple of them. In the draft I prepared in July, I just put in the adjective that the various criteria need to be substantial. And that was taken out in this draft. And when that's taken out, that means, okay, then what? And then you do get into degree, and even the substantial gets you the degree, but again, it gets you closer. So that leaves it open to basically suggest that any of these items are fine, which mine also says too, but if you just do one of them only, and it's only so much, that's also fine. And I'm not willing to go that far at this point. So to me, it's, as we said several times, it is to a large degree a matter of degree. I wouldn't foreclose the idea that one particular factor can do it. Maybe it can, but depends on what it is, and so there is a little bit left. In all of these, I think, unless you interpret it that if you do one, regardless of the degree, it's okay, then audit probably makes that easy. But in it, if we do anything other than that, then audit still has its own issues with determining whether or not it's some kind of a significant activity. And for me, I'm not willing to jettison the basic policy was to encourage substantial individual participation, encourage it, not just put it in because you have to, but really get people out, get excited, get the thing out, and get something done. If it has that meaningful result, then that's, you know, something to be considered. Regarding the but-for thing, it's the same kind of thing. I think in some cases but-for makes sense, but it's not, to me, the end-all in the analysis, and so I think it's a factor to discuss, but I wouldn't use that as the exclusive factor in any one particular given case. I would point out that even in the draft proposed by that's on the table here, and I'd like to put mine on the table now if I'd have thought about it, but I didn't. We still see a situation where the considering evidence of volunteer participation committee, the commission has previously considered and will continue to consider various types of evidence respecting the extent to which, if at all, volunteer material exemption is applicable. And then we go into photographs, sign-in sheets, affidavits, for which I have some issues with respect to a couple of past experiences with affidavits. I'm not sure that they solve the problem for audit if we're talking about those particular activities anyhow. So I think there's a number of factors that probably can be worked through, but I still think we can't eliminate the requirement that it has to be configured such a way that it's anything other than significant or substantial. Anyhow, I'm not able, like I say, to support this draft, but I'm willing to keep cranking away, and I think this discussion was good, and see if we can't ultimately come up with something. And maybe in the meantime, now that you've had the benefit of the pros and cons, that audit could, the Office of General Counsel could add some suggestions that maybe they think are worth considering.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. And as I said earlier, we're happy to keep talking at any time that you'd like to. If you'd like to provide edits to our proposal or start with some edits to the one you proposed last summer, we're happy to take a look at it. As I've told you before, one of the issues with just throwing out there is substantial volunteer involvement. One of the issues that we had with your policy over the summer is that wasn't really defined in a way that people could objectively know what you meant by that. And that's why the list for us, you know, answers that question and provides, you know, the highest amount of guidance possible. But as doors are always open, we're happy to talk in the future. I think this question, this conversation was very helpful, and we better understand where we are on this issue, and maybe potentially someday in the future we can work it out. But for now, we'll at least know where people stand, and I'm sure Lorenzo is, you know, thinking it's all solved for me now. I know exactly what to do when I go back to working with the audit division this afternoon. You're ready to go. Thanks again for all your help on this issue. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of agenda document number 18-03-A, which is the proposed interim enforcement policy on volunteer mail exemption.
Thank you. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails. Commissioner Goodman, Commissioner Peterson, and I vote to approve, and the Vice Chair and Commissioner Walther voted no. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.